and there was a blankness in his eyes, vacancy and shame. Lee thought, he does not know what's happening. Heath coughed.
Sir, beg to report.
Yes?
Very strange, sir. Situation very confused.
What happened?
Lee's eyes were wide and very dark. Heath said painfully,
Sir, I moved in this morning as directed. I thought it was only a few militia, but it was dismounted cavalry.
John Buford.
Well, there weren't all that many, and it was only cavalry, so I just decided to push on it. The boys wouldn't hold back. I thought we shouldn't ought to be stopped by a few dismounted cavalry, but they made a good fight. I didn't expect... They really put up a scrap.
Yes. Lee was watching his eyes. Heath grimaced, blowing.
Well, sir, they wouldn't leave. My boys got the dander up. We deployed the whole division and went after them. We just about had them running, and then all of a sudden I see us moving in on infantry. They got infantry support up from the south. The boys got pushed back. Then we reformed and tried again. Couldn't stop there, sir. But there's more infantry now. I don't know how many. But I don't know what else we could have done. Sir, I'm sorry. But it started out as a minor scrap with a few militia, and the next thing I know, I'm tangling with half the Union Army.
Who are they?
Sir?
Lee was watching the fight, which was now relatively quiet. The smoke was clearing, blowing toward the north. He could see blue troops moving in the trees on the Union right, moving out on the flank. He looked north, but he could see nothing beyond the ridge. The blue troops seemed to be pulling back that way, retreating, reforming. Strange. The battery up by the cupola had stopped firing. Riding up through the haze, Dorsey Pender. Letter from a pious wife.
To Heath, Lee said, What units have you engaged?
The cavalry was Buford, sir. Two brigades. They really fought. Then there was the First Corps, the Black Hats, John Reynolds' old corps. Then there was another corps, but we still haven't got it identified.
At Lee's shoulder, Taylor said quietly, insistently, General, you are in range of the enemy batteries? Lee said, It's quiet now. He looked once more at Heath. His anger died. No time for blame. But there must be information. Taylor insisted, You gentlemen are standing together. May I suggest that you move at least to the shelter of the trees? There was a sudden fire on the left, a burst in the north. Lee felt an acute spasm of real anger. He clutched his chest.
I know nothing!
Heath said.
I'd better look to my flank.
He moved away. A rider came up. Courier from Rhodes.
General Rhodes' compliments, sir. I have the honor to inform you that the general has joined the engagement with his entire division and is attacking the Union right. He begs me to inform you that General Early is behind him and will be on the field within the hour. Do you have any instructions, sir?
Lee felt a thrill of delight mixed with alarm. Rhodes had come in right on the Union flank. The blue troops were turning to meet a new threat. And Early was close behind, a flank assault already begun. Lee sat staring north. No way to tell. He could order forward the entire army. Heath was here and Pender. Rhodes' attack might almost have been planned. But he did not know how many Federals were ahead. Rhodes might be attacking half the Union army, another Sharpsburg. And yet I cannot call him back. He is already committed. Lee said,
Nothing for now. Wait here.
He turned to Taylor. I want all possible knowledge of the enemy's strength. Ride forward yourself and observe. And be careful. Taylor saluted formally and rode off, the grin breaking across his face just as he turned. Lee turned and began heading back toward the road. Now Heath was back.
Sir, Rhodes is heavily engaged. Shall I attack?
Lee shook his head, then said loudly, No! He rode on. Then he said over his shoulder, We are not yet prepared for a full engagement. Longstreet is not up. Heath said, "There aren't that many of the enemy, sir.
What are your casualties?"
"Moderate, sir. There's been some fighting, but Pender is in position. Together, sir, we could sweep them."
Lee waited. It did not feel right. There was something heavy and dark and tight about the day, riding stiffly in the broad, barren field in harsh sunlight. The firing in the north was mounting. Batteries of artillery had opened up.
"Who is commanding there?"
Lee pointed to the hills beyond the town.
Heath blinked, suddenly remembering.
"Sir, I'd forgotten. We have word that General Reynolds was killed."
Lee turned.
"John Reynolds?"
"Yes, sir. Prisoners state he was killed this morning. I believe Doubleday has succeeded him."
"Are you sure?"
"The news seems reliable."
"I'm sorry," Lee said.
His mind flashed a vision of Reynolds. A neat, trim man. A gentleman. A friend. Lee shook his head. It was queer to be so strange and tight in the mind. He seemed unable to think clearly. Reynolds dead. Gone. Doubleday behind him. Doubleday an unknown quantity, but certainly nothing spectacular. But Reynolds' first corps was solid. What to do?
"I can support Rhodes, sir," Heath said.
Lee looked at him. He knows he has brought this on. He wants to fight now to retrieve it. His answer is to fight, not to think. To fight, pure and simple. Lee rode slowly forward, nearing the trees ahead alongside the road. You can depend on the troops, but can you count on the generals? Why has Rhodes attacked? Will Hill fight well, or Rhodes either?
What I need is Longstreet, and he is not here. A mistake to bring him up last.
Another courier.
"General Early has arrived. Begs to report that he is attacking to the north of General Rhodes."
Lee stopped, looked north. It was working almost like a plan. It was possible to see intention in it. The Union formed to face him and fought well and now was being flanked from the north, simply because Lee's men had orders to come to Gettysburg, and they were coming in almost behind the Union defenses. Lee felt a sharpness in the air. His blood was rising. He had tried to be discreet, but it was all happening without him, without one decision. It was all in God's hands. And yet he could leave it alone himself no longer. Rhodes and Early were attacking. Heath and Pender were waiting here in front of him. Lee's instinct sensed opportunity. "Let us all go in together, as God has decreed a fight here." He swung to Heath. "General, you may attack." To Pender, he said the same. He gave no further directions. The generals would know what to do now. With that word, it was out of his hands. It had never really been in his hands at all. And yet his was the responsibility. He rode forward to the rise ahead, across the small creek. Now he had a clearer view. Pender's division was on the move. He heard the great scream of the massed rebel yells. Now batteries were in position behind him, beginning to open up on the woods near the cupola. Lee ducked his head as the shot whickered over him. He did not like to stand in front of artillery. Some of the artillery was moving forward. Rifle fire was breaking out. The wind shifted. He was enveloped in smoke. Marshall's face appeared, an incoherent message. Lee tried to find some place to watch the assault. Pender's whole force was streaming forward across the fields, into the woods. Lee saw flags floating through white smoke, disembodied like walking sticks. Shell bursts were appearing in the air, white flakes, round puffs. One blossomed near. There was Marshall again. Lee heard fragments split the air near him. He moved into a grove of trees, oak, chestnut. There was a white house nearby, a white rail fence, a dead horse lying in a black mound in the sun. He waited in the grove, listening to the enormous sound of war. Eventually he sat, resting himself against the bole of a tree. It was dark and cool back in here out of the sun. Men were dying up ahead. He took off his hat, ran his fingers through his hair, felt his life beating in his chest. The fight went on.
Lee thought for the first time that day of his son, Rooney, wounded, lying not far from here. He closed his eyes, prayed for his boy, for all of them. He put his hand down on black dirt, was reminded, Pennsylvania, I am the invader. Once more the rebel yell, inhuman screaming of the onrushing dead. Another unit was going. He rose and went forward, trying to see, but no point in that. There was too much smoke. Yet it might help if he was seen. He moved up out of the grove of trees onto the road. The road ahead was crowded with wounded. There were men lying under wagons, out of the sun, most of them semi-naked, covered with bandages, blood. He saw another dead horse, a splintered wagon. The severed forefoot of a horse lay near him in gray dust. Smoke was pouring down the road as from a great furnace. He moved forward, his staff following him. Here was A.P. Hill. Hill said, white-faced, "Very hard going. Heath is down." Lee looked at him, waiting. "Wounded in the head. I don't know how serious. But the division is moving. Pender is on the flank. But the Yankees are fighting well. I don't recall them fighting this well before." Hill seemed peculiarly calm, vacant, as if he was not wholly present. He was a handsome man who had a great deal of money but was not society, and was overly aware of it and very touchy about it. Lee said, "Let me know General Heath's condition as soon as possible." Lee sat down against a rail fence. A band came by, playing an incoherent song, fifes and bugles. The sky was overcast with blowing white smoke, the smell of hot guns, of blasted earth, the sweet smell of splintery trees. Lee was in the way, in the road. Men were gathering around him, calling to him. He saw a house, an empty front porch. He moved toward that way and stared down toward the smoke. Firing was intense. He sent couriers to Early and Rhodes to advise them of his new headquarters and to ask for progress. He had no idea of the whereabouts of Ewell, who was supposed to be in command over there and who probably knew less of what was happening than Lee did. Longstreet was right. Command was too loose. But no time for that now. A courier from Early. The enemy was falling back. Lee could hear an officer near him erupt in a high scream. "They're running! Great God Almighty, they're running!" Lee looked down the smoky street, saw a man helping another man along the road, saw masses of men moving vaguely through a field, saw flashes of artillery. The fire seemed to be slowing down. There were many men yelling. A lieutenant came down the road, pointing back toward the smoke, yelling wildly that someone was hurt. A.P. Hill said at Lee's elbow, "General Heath's surgeon has examined him, sir. He says he ought to be all right, but he will be out of action for a while." "Where is he?" "In a house over this way," Hill pointed. "You will take good care of him, of course. And, General, see to yourself. You can do no more good now. I want you to rest." Hill said softly, calmly, vacantly, "I'm fine, General. Just fine." But he looked as if he were about to faint. Lee was thinking, if Longstreet were only here. How many in the Union Army? If the First Corps is here and the 11th, the rest must not be far behind. He heard more men yelling. In the street he saw officers waving their hats, grinning enormous grins. Victory? A rider came up from Pender. A young man with a marvelous wide mustache said, "General Pender begs to report the enemy has fallen back." Officers threw hats in the air. Lee smiled, could not be heard. One man touched him, another patted his back. He raised his glasses and looked to the clearing smoke. He turned to Marshall. "I'll go forward." Traveler was at the rail outside. Lee mounted and rode. Men were cheering him now, touching the horse as he went by. He tried to control his face. The wounded were everywhere. Some of them were Union boys, looking at him insensibly as he went by. A courier from Early, a rout on the left flank. The Union 11th Corps was running. More cheers. Lee closed his eyes once briefly. God's will. My trust in thee. O Lord, bless you and thank you. He moved forward to the rise ahead, across a small creek. Taylor said, This must be Willoughby Run. Lee halted at the crest. Now he could see. The land lay before him wreathed in smoky ridges. Half a mile away lay the town, white board buildings, dirt roads. Beyond it was a high hill that rose above a series of ridges running off to the east. Blue troops were pouring back through the town, moving up the sides of the hill. The couriers were right. They were retreating. Victory. Lee put his glasses to his eyes, felt his hands tremble, focused, saw. Union artillery forming on the high hill, men digging. The fight was not over. Must not let those men occupy the high ground. Lee turned. To Taylor he said, Find Hill's chief of artillery. Tell him I want fire placed on that hill. I don't want it occupied. What word do you have from Ewell? And send General Hill to me. Taylor moved off. Lee was thinking, We must continue the assault. The blue troops are on the move. Now we must keep them moving. But Heath is down. He looked for Pender's courier, informed him to tell General Pender to continue the assault. But Early and Rhodes were closer on the left. If they only kept moving. The guns on the high hill were beginning to fire. Here was Powell Hill, looking worse. He said, The men have done all they can do. Heath's division is exhausted. Pender says he has had the hardest fighting of the war. Lee studied him, looked away, back to the hill above Gettysburg. Hill may be sick, but Pender was trustworthy. If Pender had doubts, Taylor arrived. General Ewell is with General Early, sir. We are in communication. Good, Lee said. Deliver this message in person. Tell General Ewell, the Federal troops are retreating in confusion. It is only necessary to push those people to get possession of those heights. Of course, I do not know his situation, and I do not want him to engage a superior force, but I do want him to take that hill, if he thinks practicable, as soon as possible. Remind him that Longstreet is not yet up. Taylor repeated the message, rode off. Beyond that hill, Lee could begin to feel the weight of the Union Army, the massive blue force pouring his way. What kind of a soldier would Meade turn out to be? We must not give him the high ground. Lee looked southeast, saw two rounded hills. We might swing around that way. They have marched quicker than I expected. Thank the Lord for Longstreet's spy. He heard more cheering to the rear, looked, saw Longstreet, moving forward slowly, calmly, like a black rock, grinning hungrily through the black beard. Lee flushed with pleasure. Longstreet dismounted, extended a hand. Congratulations, General. Wish I could have been here. Lee took the hand warmly. Come here. I want you to see this. He waved toward the field ahead, the hill beyond Gettysburg. An officer near him said, General Lee, is Second Manassas all over again? Not quite, Lee said cheerily. Not quite. He was delighted to have Longstreet here. Now, through the streets, Johnson's division was moving. Longstreet's people could not be far behind. With every step of a soldier, with every tick of the clock, the army was gaining safety, closer to victory, closer to the dream of independence. Longstreet studied the field. After a moment, he said, We were lucky. It couldn't have worked better if we had planned it. Longstreet nodded. Lee explained the position that Ewell had orders to move to the left and take that hill. Longstreet studied the hill, Cemetery Hill, while Lee spoke. After a moment he said, Fine, but this is fine. This is almost perfect. He turned to Lee. They're right where we want them. All we have to do is swing around that way, he pointed toward Washington, and get between them and Lincoln, and find some good high ground. And they'll have to hit us. They'll have to. And we'll have them, General. We'll have them. His eyes were flashing. He was as excited as Lee had ever seen him. Lee said, amazed,
"You mean you want me to disengage?"
"Of course." Longstreet seemed surprised. "You certainly don't mean." "Sir, I have been under the impression that it would be our strategy to conduct a defensive campaign wherever possible in order to keep this army intact."
"Granted.
But the situation has changed."
"In what way?"
"We cannot disengage. We have already pushed them back. How can we move off in the face of the enemy?"
Longstreet pointed. "Very simply, around to the right. He will occupy those heights and wait to see what we are going to do. He always has. Meade is new to the command. He will not move quickly."
Lee put his hand to his face. He looked toward the hill and saw the broken Union Corps falling back up the slope. He felt only one urge, to press on and get it done. He said nothing, turning away. There was a messenger from General Ewell. Lee recognized the man, Captain James Powers Smith, Ewell's aide. The captain was delighted to see the commanding general. Ewell's message was cautious. "General Ewell says he will direct Early and Rhodes to move forward, but he requests support of General Hill on his right. He says that there is a strong Union position south of the town which should be taken at once." Lee asked which position Ewell meant. He handed Smith the glasses. Smith said the position was beyond the one in front, at the top of which there was a cemetery. Lee looked at his watch. It was almost 5 o'clock. Still 2 hours of daylight. He said to Longstreet, "General, how far away is your lead division?"
"McLaws, about 6 miles. He is beyond Johnson's train of wagons."
Lee shook his head. To Smith he said, "I have no force to attack the hill. General Hill's corps has had hard fighting. Tell General Ewell to take that hill if at all possible. Have you seen Major Taylor?"
"No, sir."
"You must have just passed him." Lee sent Smith away. He remembered. He had ordered artillery to fire on the hill, but none was firing. He sent to find out why. He began to realize he was really very tired. But if a strong Union force was on a hill to the south... But without Longstreet's corps, a general assault was impossible. Where was the artillery? Where was Hill? Why had Early and Rhodes stopped their attacks? He could see the town below choked with soldiers, horses, but there was no advance. He turned, saw Longstreet watching him. He had the look of a man suppressing his thoughts. Lee said, "Say it, General."
"We shouldn't have attacked here, General. Heath had his orders."
Lee waved a hand. "I know that, but we have pushed them back."
"In the morning, we will be outnumbered."
Lee shrugged. Numbers were meaningless. "Had I paid attention to numbers, General?" Lee left the rest unsaid. Longstreet said,
"If we moved south, toward Washington, we could fight on ground of our own choosing. The enemy is here, General. We did not want the fight, but the fight is here. What if I ask this army to retreat?"
"They will do as you order."
Lee shook his head again. He was growing weary of this. Why didn't Ewell's assault begin? A cautious commander new to his command. An A.P. Hill is sick, yet we won. The soldiers won. Lee pointed toward the hill. "They will probably retreat, or Ewell will push them off. But if Meade is there tomorrow, I will attack him."
"If Meade is there," Longstreet said implacably, "it is because he wants you to attack him."
That was enough. Lee thought, docile men do not make good soldiers. He said nothing. Longstreet could see the conversation was at an end. He said,
"I'll bring my boys up as soon as I can."
Lee nodded. As Longstreet was going, Lee said, "General?"
"Yes, sir."
"Your spy was correct in his reports. Had it not been for that report, this army might have been destroyed in detail."
"I thank you."
Longstreet nodded. If the compliment pleased him, he did not show it. He moved off. Lee stood alone, troubled. He had had enough of defensive war. The king of spades. Let us attack, and let it be done. I am extraordinarily tired. You are an old man, and if something happens to you... He picked up the glasses, waiting for Ewell's attack. No attack began. 4. Chamberlain. Chamberlain rode slowly forward into the western sun. It was soft, green country, a land of orchards and good big barns. Here and there along the road, people came out to see the troops go by, and there were a few cheers, but most of the people were silent and glum, not hostile, apprehensive. The sight was depressing. Some of them were selling food to the troops. One farmer had a stand offering cold milk for sale at outrageous prices, and after Chamberlain was passed, there was a scuffle, and some of the men requisitioned the milk and told him to charge it to the U.S. government. Chamberlain heard but did not look back. It was beginning to be very hot, and Chamberlain closed his eyes to let the salt sweat gather in the corners of his eyelids and wiped it away and rode with his eyes closed, himself tucked away back in the dark under his hat. When he opened his eyes again, the day was violently bright and very dusty. And so he rode half asleep, eyes partly closed, dreaming. At noon they reached the Pennsylvania border. Now there were more people, and they were much more friendly, and the band behind struck up Yankee Doodle. Now the farmers began to hand out free food. Chamberlain smelt fresh bread baking. A very pretty young girl with long blonde hair rushed up to him and pressed a warm cake into his hand, and he was embarrassed. The regiment greeted the girl with cheers. It was good to be first in line, no dust ahead. Chamberlain swiveled in the saddle and looked back down the road, and there, down in the dust like a huge blue snake, came the whole Fifth Corps along the winding road. Some men on horses riding high in black hats among the tilting flags. More bands were playing. Chamberlain wiped sweat from his eyes. It was time to dismount. A good officer rode as little as possible. He got down from the horse and began to march along in the dust, in the heat. Near him he could hear Tom Chamberlain talking to one of the new men from the 2nd Maine, explaining the ways of this regiment. Tom was proud. Not too proud. The 2nd Maine had seen more action. Chamberlain thought of Tom, and his mind wandered back to Maine. Young Tom lost, in the dark of winter. A long search, mother crying. We never found him. He survived out there and came back himself, a grinning kid with a bright red nose, never once afraid. One of the things you get to know, Tom Chamberlain was saying, is that this here brigade has got its own special bugle call. You ever heard tell of Dan Butterfield? General Butterfield, what was with Hooker? Right, same man. Well, he used to be our brigade commander.
They say he was a pistol. No man like him for having a good time.
He gave a lewd wink, suggestion of coarseness.
Well, I don't know about that, but he liked to write bugle calls. Trouble with his army is too many bugle calls. Call for artillery and infantry and get up and eat and retreat and all that, and it got a mite confusing. So old Dan Butterfield wrote a call for this here brigade, special. If there was an order for this brigade, well, somebody else would be blowing his blame bugle and we'd think it was for us, only it wasn't. But we would follow the order anyway, and next thing you know, we'd be in trouble. That happened to us once, the main man said. Half the regiment charged, and the other half retreated.
You had your choice, he chuckled.
Seems a good system, come to think of it. Well, in this brigade, we got a special call. You hear that call, and you know the next call is for you. Goes like this. Bum, 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 bum. We call it Dan Butterfield. Just like this. Dan, 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 Butterfield, Butterfield.
The main man said glumly, "In the middle of a fight, I'm supposed to remember that?" It's easy if you remember. He sang it again. Din, 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 Butterfield, Butterfield.
The main man said.
Old Butterfield wrote a lot of bugle calls. You know Butterfield's lullaby?
Butterfield's what?
Tom hummed a few bars of what was still known as Butterfield's lullaby, but which the army would later know as Taps, and which now had no connotation of death, which simply meant rest for the night. Rest after a long day in the dust and the sun, with the bugles blaring. And Joshua Chamberlain, listening, thought of the sound of Butterfield's lullaby coming out of the dark through a tent flap, with the campfires burning warm and red in the night. And Chamberlain thought, you can grow to love it. Amazing. Chamberlain let his eyes close down to the slits, retreating within himself. He had learned that you could sleep on your feet on the long marches. You set your feet to going, and after a while they went by themselves, and you sort of turned your attention away, and your feet went on walking painlessly, almost without feeling, and gradually you closed down your eyes so that all you could see were the heels of the man in front of you. One heel, other heel. One heel, other heel. And so you moved on dreamily in the heat and the dust, closing your eyes against the sweat, head down and gradually darkening. So you actually slept with the sight of the heels in front of you, one heel, other heel, and often when the man in front of you stopped, you bumped into him. There were no heels today. But there was the horse he led by the reins. He did not know the name of this horse. He did not bother any more. The horses were all dead too soon. Yet you learn to love it. Isn't that amazing? Long marches and no rest, up very early in the morning and asleep late in the rain, and there's a marvelous excitement to it, a joy to wake in the morning and feel the army all around you, and see the campfires in the morning and smell the coffee. Awake all night in front of Fredericksburg. We attacked in the afternoon, just at dusk, and the stone wall was aflame from one end to the other. Too much smoke, couldn't see. The attack failed. Couldn't withdraw. Lay there all night in the dark, in the cold, among the wounded and dying. Piled up bodies in front of you to catch the bullets, using the dead for a shield. Remember the sound? Of bullets and dead bodies? Like a shot into a rotten leg. A wet, thick leg. All a man is, wet leg of blood. Remember the flap of a torn curtain in a blasted window, fragment whispering in that awful breeze. Never, forever, never, forever. You have a professor's mind. But that is the way it sounded. Never, forever. Love that, too? Not love it. Not quite. And yet, I was never so alive. Maine is silent and cold. Maine in the winter. Air is darker. The sky is a deeper dark. A darkness comes with winter that these southern people don't know. Snow falls so much earlier, and in the winter you can walk in the snowfield among bushes, and visitors don't know that the bushes are the tops of tall pines, and you're standing in 30 feet of snow. Visitors. Once long ago, visitors in the dead of winter, a preacher preaching hellfire, scared the fool out of me, and I resented it. And Pa said I was right. Pa. When he thought of the old man, he could see him suddenly in a field in the spring, trying to move a gray boulder. He always knew instinctively the ones you could move, even though the greater part was buried in the earth, and he expected you to move the rock and not discuss it. A hard and silent man, an honest man, a noble man. Little humor, but sometimes the door opened and you saw the warmth within, a long way off. A certain sadness, a slow, remote, unfathomable quality. as if the man wanted to be closer to the world but did not know how. Once Chamberlain had a speech memorized from Shakespeare and gave it proudly, the old man listening but not looking, and Chamberlain remembered it still. What a piece of work is man, in action how like an angel. And the old man, grinning, had scratched his head and then said stiffly, Well, boy, if he's an angel, he's sure a murdering angel. And Chamberlain had gone on to school to make an oration on the subject, Man, the Killer Angel. And when the old man heard about it, he was very proud, and Chamberlain felt very good remembering it. The old man was proud of his son, the colonel, of infantry. But what do you thought of the speech this morning? Home and mother. Mother wanted me to be a parson. Vincent picked me. Me! To lead the regiment. Folks back home will know by now. Commander of the regiment. Why me? What did Vincent see? He turned his mind away from that. Think on it when the time comes. You think too much beforehand, and you get too self-conscious and tight, and you don't function well. He knew that he was an instinctive man, not a planner, and he did his best when he fell back on instinct. Think of music now, and singing. Pass the time with a bit of harmony. Hum songs, and rest. But it was very hot. Could use some main cool now. Home. One place is just like another, really. Maybe not. But truth is, it's all just rock and dirt. And people are roughly the same. I was born up there, but I'm no stranger here. I've always felt at home everywhere. Even in Virginia, where they hate me. Everywhere you go, there's nothing but the same rock and dirt. And houses, and people, and deer, and birds. They give it all names, but I'm at home everywhere. Odd thing. Unpatriotic. I was at home in England. I would be at home in the desert. In Afghanistan, or far Taipei. All mine. It all belongs to me. My world. Tom Chamberlain was saying, You should have seen the last commander, Old Ames. He was the worst. I mean to tell you, the triple-toed, half-wound, spotted mule worst. Where were you boys at Chancellorsville? Well now, a painful subject. Joshua Chamberlain opened his eyes. The fact is, Tom said gloomily, we was not engaged. Well now, a lot of us weren't engaged. That there hooker, I hear he froze right up like a pond in the dark. Well, we had us a misfortune. Tom turned eyes sad as a trout. He was a lean, happy, excitable man who had turned out to be calm and serene in battle. Soldiering was beginning to intrigue him. The thing was, damn, we had these here inoculations. You ever been inoculated? The man swore earnestly. Tom nodded. Well, then you know. Only thing was, we wound up sick, half the dang regiment. And come time for the fight at Chancellorsville, our surgeon major, that's a stumble-fingered man named Wormy Monroe, he up and reported us unfit for combat. So they went ahead and sent us back to mind the dang telegraph wires. We wasn't allowed to associate with nobody. Old Lawrence there, he went on up and argued, but wouldn't nobody come near us. It was like he was carrying the plague. Lawrence said, hang it, we ought to be the first ones in. We'd probably give the Rebs a disease and be more useful than any other outfit in the whole army. Matter of fact, way things turned, we probably would have been more use than most of them people. Anyway, we wasn't in it. The main man was chuckling. Chamberlain thought, would have thought mountain men were tougher than city boys. But mountain men get all the diseases. City boys get immune as they grow up. We were 1,000 strong when we left Maine. Gallant 600. Half a league. It was quieter now. No one was talking. Sound of troops at route step, shuffle in the dust. Dull clink of mess kits. A band in the distance, tinny, forlorn. Raw call of a cow in the sunlight. A voice in his ear. A hand on his arm.
Colonel, sir, exasperated. Beg the colonel's pardon, but would the colonel do us all a favor and get back on that damned horse?
Colonel opened his eyes into the glare, saw Tozier. Color Sergeant Tozier. A huge man with a huge nose, sweat bubbling all over his face.
I tell you, sir, be a damn sight easier handling these here new recruits if the officers would act like they got sense. Sir.
Chamberlain blinked, wiped at his sweat. Some of the men were watching with that odd, soft look on their faces that still surprised Chamberlain. He started to say something, shook his head. Tozier was right. He mounted the horse. Tozier said,
"How are you, sir?"
Chamberlain nodded, grinned weakly.
"We don't need no more new commanding officers," Tozier said. "Here, you, lieutenant, keep an eye on the colonel."
Tom said,
"Yes, sir."
Tozier departed. Chamberlain thought,
"Good thing old Ames didn't see him.
My boys. Ames shaped them, but they're mine. Year ago, they held meetings to decide what to do. If they disagreed with an officer, they stopped and argued. Can't conduct an army as a town meeting." They were coming into Hanover. Out in a field, dead bodies lay in untidy rows. The arms were up above the heads. The clothes were scattered. Shoes were missing. The hair of some was flickering in the wind, and they looked alive. Chamberlain learned. Stewart had been through here, and there'd been a brush. The sight of dead men awakened them all. A clear day, very hot. Winds swinging to the south, buzzards ahead. As they rode, ladies waved handkerchiefs, a band played the Star-Spangled Banner. Chamberlain wondered, will the people here let the buzzards have them? Or will they bury them, Stuart's men? The people of Hanover were delighted to see them. Now, as they got closer to the rebels, people seemed much happier everywhere. Happiness seemed to increase in direct proportion to how close you were. When we actually get there, Chamberlain thought, it will be easy to tell. The men will be kissing you. Chamberlain rode upright through the town. On the far side, he slumped again. For a short while, General Vincent came up to ride with him. Vincent was the new brigade commander, a very handsome man with thick sideburns from the 83rd Pennsylvania. He had a good reputation, and he had the air of a man who knew what he was doing. But Chamberlain had seen that air before. Hooker had it. And if ever there was a man who did not know what he was doing... Vincent had heard about the 114 volunteers. He was impressed. He thought that things were looking up. The army was ready for a fight. That in itself was an impressive fact, after all that had happened. He showed Chamberlain the new brigade flag, triangular, white, with a blue border, a red Maltese cross in the center. The man looked at it without interest. It meant nothing much as yet. Vincent rode back. The man from the 2nd Maine said sadly, "You ever hear about our flag? It cost $1,200. But the men were tired. There was silence again. Chamberlain saw a rider going to the rear, a blue courier. Then there was the first wagon, then another. There was fighting at Gettysburg. Off against the horizon he could see a haze, a dark haze, as of dirt stirred into the air. Nothing to do now but rest on the march. The troops became very still. It was darker now. The land around them was hilly and green, turning slowly gold, then hazy purple. It was a beautiful afternoon. At dark, word came forward to go into bivouac. Vincent came up and stopped the column, and the men moved gratefully out into a field, carrying the rails of the fences with them for evening fires. They had marched more than 20 miles again. It was now 100 miles in 5 days. Now, for the first time, the new Maine men heard the call, Dan, 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 Butterfield, Butterfield.
And then down the road came more riders, rushing to the rear on lathered horses. Chamberlain looked up to watch them go, sensing alarm. He could feel the gray army beyond the hills. A moment later, there came the bugle call. Dan, 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 Butterfield, Butterfield. Then, forward. A universal groan. No rest now. The rattle of the rails being dropped. A general cursing. Chamberlain reformed the regiment out in the road. Dispatch from Vincent. Move out. Word of what had happened moved slowly down the column, but it was a long while before word came down to Chamberlain. By that time it was well after dark, and the moon was rising, yellow in hazy air, huge in the trees, gazing like one single vacant eye, and Vincent rode up. Two corps had been engaged at Gettysburg and had been driven off. The first corps had done well, but the 11th, those damn Dutchmen, had run again, as they did at Chancellorsville. Now the first was holding and screaming back for reinforcements. John Reynolds was hurt, possibly killed. Proceed with all possible speed. Chamberlain did not protest. In the darkness he could feel his strength rising, coming over him in the cooler air of evening. Not far to Gettysburg now. He could hear no guns. But now, along the roadway, there were people rushing out, people lining the rail fences, anxious, overjoyed. From houses back off away from the road, there was a waving of flags, a fluttering of white handkerchiefs. Women lifted lamps at the windows. There were many healthy-looking young men lining the road, and some of the men from Maine grumbled. But the rest were too tired. Chamberlain saw some staggering, then one fell out. He collapsed in a clatter of falling rifle, of mess tins rattling in the dust. He was pulled aside. Chamberlain arranged a detail to pick up fallen men. On and on. Now it was much darker, and the moon was high. And then ahead there was an officer, a staff officer, sitting on a black horse. He rode out to meet Chamberlain as he passed.
Colonel, tell your men. General McClellan has assumed command of the army.
Chamberlain did not have to spread the word. It went down the ranks like a wind in wheat. Some of the men cheered hoarsely. One man fired a rifle. And then Tozier talked to him. For a long moment, Chamberlain believed it. McClellan was back. God bless old Lincoln. The only general of the whole mess who knew what he was doing. But then the troops moved on and the moon went behind a cloud. And Chamberlain knew that it could not be true. But the men marched, believing they were behind McClellan. He was the only general Chamberlain had ever seen who was truly loved. The Rebs loved Lee, no doubt of that, and we loved Mac. Chamberlain thought, two things an officer must do to lead men. This from old Ames, who never cared about love. You must care for your men's welfare. You must show physical courage. Well, Chamberlain thought, there's no McClellan. There's only Meade, whom none of these people know, let alone like, and he'll be cautious. So I've taken care, as best I can, of their welfare. Now, tomorrow, we'll see about the courage. Now there were the wounded, the stragglers. Men limped back, sat out in the fields making fires, sulked along eastward, out in the dark. Now there were rumors, a terrible defeat. Someone had blundered. 200,000 Rebs. The 11th Corps had deserted. Chamberlain ordered his men to close up and keep moving and not to talk. Damn the rumors. You never knew what was true until days or weeks or even months afterward. He called, "Close up! Close up!" First order he had given since morning. And then shortly after that, the order came to stop. At last. It was almost midnight. There were clouds again, and it was very dark, but Chamberlain could see a hill in front of him and masses of troops and tents ahead. The 20th Maine went off the road, and most went to sleep without fires, some without pitching tents, for the night was warm and without a wind. Chamberlain asked a passing courier, "How far to Gettysburg?"
and the man pointed back over his shoulder. You're there, Colonel. You're there. Chamberlain lay down to rest. It was just after midnight. He wondered if McClellan would really be back. He prayed for a leader. For his boys. 5. Longstreet. He rode out of Gettysburg just after dark. His headquarters were back on the Cashtown Road, and so he rode back over the battlefield of the day. His staff recognized his mood and left him discreetly alone. He was riding slumped forward, head down, hat over his eyes. One by one they left him, moving ahead, cheering up when they were out of his company. He passed a hospital wagon, saw mounded limbs glowing whitely in the dark, a pile of legs, another of arms. It looked like masses of fat white spiders. He stopped in the road and lighted a cigar, looking around him at the tents and the wagons, listening to the rumble and music of the army in the night. There were a few groans, dead sounds from dying earth, most of them soft and low. There was a fire far off, a large fire in a grove of trees, men outlined against a great glare. A band was playing something discordant, unrecognizable. A dog passed him, trotted through the light of an open tent flap, paused, looked, inspected the ground, padded silently into the dark. Fragments of cloth, trees, chewed bits of paper littered the road. Longstreet took it all in, began to move on. He passed a black mound which seemed strange in the dark, lumpy, misshapen. He rode over and saw dead horses. He rode away from the field, toward higher ground. Lee would attack in the morning. Clear enough. Time and place not yet set, but he will attack. Fixed and unturnable, a runaway horse. Longstreet felt a depression so profound it deadened him. Gazing back on that black hill above Gettysburg, that high, lighted hill already speckled with fires among the gravestones, he smelled disaster like distant rain. It was Longstreet's curse to see the thing clearly. He was a brilliant man who was slow in speech and slow to move and silent-faced as stone. He had not the power to convince. He sat on the horse, turning his mind away, willing it away as a gun barrel swivels. And then he thought of his children, powerless to stop that vision. It blossomed, a black picture. She stood in the doorway. The boy is dead. She didn't even say his name. She didn't even cry. Longstreet took a long, deep breath. In the winter, the fever had come to Richmond. In a week, they were dead. All within a week. All three. He saw the sweet faces. Moment of enormous pain. The thing had pushed him out of his mind. Insane, but no one knew it. They looked at the plain, blunt, stubborn face and saw nothing but dull Dutch eyes. The great darkness. The silence. He had not thought God would do a thing like that. He went to church and asked, and there was no answer. He got down on his knees and pleaded, but there was no answer. She kept standing in the doorway. The boy is dead. And he could not even help her, could say nothing, could not move, could not even take her into his arms. Nothing to give. One strength he did not have. Oh, God, my boy is dead. He had tears in his eyes. Turn away from that. He mastered it. What he had left was the army. The boys were here. He even had the father, in place of God, old Robert Lee. Rest with that. Abide with that. His aides were all gone, all but two. Gory hung back from him in the growing dark. He rode on alone, silently, Gory trailing like a hunting dog, and met one of his surgeons coming up from camp. J.S.D. Cullen, delighted, having heard of the great victory. And Longstreet succeeded in depressing him, and Cullen departed. Longstreet lectured himself. Depression is contagious. Keep it to yourself. He needed something to cheer him, turned to two men behind him, found there was only one, not an aide, the Englishman Fremantle. Exactly what he needed. Longstreet drew up to wait. The Englishman came pleasantly, slowly forward. He was the kind of breezy, cheery man who brings humor with his presence. He was wearing the same tall gray hat and the remarkable coat. He said cheerily, tapping the great hat, "Don't mean to intrude upon your thoughts, General."
"Not at all," Longstreet said.
"Really, sir, if you'd rather ride alone—"
"Good to see you," Longstreet said.
The Englishman rode up, grinning broadly through widely spaced teeth. He had entered the country by way of Mexico, riding in a wagon drawn by a tobacco-chewing man, who had turned out to be, in his spare time, the local judge. Fremantle had seen many interesting things. A casual hanging, raw floods, great fires. He was continually amazed at the combination of raw earth and rough people, white-columned houses, and traces of English manor. He had not gotten used to the crude habit of shaking hands, which was common among these people, but he forced himself. He was enjoying himself hugely. He had not changed his clothes in some days, and he looked delightfully disreputable, yet mannered and cool and light in the saddle. Longstreet grinned again.
"Did you get a chance to see anything?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, I did. I found a rather large tree, and Lawley and I sat out in the open, and there was quite a show. Lovely. Oh, lovely."
"You didn't happen to see a cavalry charge?"
"Stuart, not yet returned." "Not a one," Fremantle gloomed, "nor a hollow square. You know, sir, we really ought to discuss that at length on some occasion, provided this war lasts long enough, which most people seem to think it won't. You fellows seem to do well enough without it, I must say. But still, one likes to feel a certain security in these matters, which the square gives, do you see? One likes to know that is where everyone is at given moments. Ah, but then," he took a deep breath, tapped his chest, "there's always tomorrow. I gather you expect a bit of an adventure tomorrow." Longstreet nodded.
"Well, I shall try to find a position of advantage. I will appreciate your advice, although, of course, if I'm ever in the way at all, you must feel free. I mean, one must not hamper operations. Don't spare my feelings, sir.
But if you'll tell me where to stand—"
"I will." Fremantle whacked a mosquito. "Another victory today.
When I am clear about it all, I shall write it down. Expect you chaps are getting rather used to victory, what?"
"Damn!"
He swatted another bug.
"Must say, enormously impressive, this army. Yet the federal fellas just keep on coming.
Curious. I have a bit of difficulty, you know, understanding exactly why. Sometime when there's time—but the war is ending, of course. I can feel that myself. That is the message I shall transmit to my people. No doubt of it." He eyed Longstreet. Longstreet said nothing. "Your General Lee is a wonder."
"Yes," Longstreet said.
"A thing one rarely sees." Fremantle paused. "Remarkable," he said. He was about to say something else, but changed his mind.
"He holds this army together," Longstreet said.
"Extraordinary dignity."
"Extraordinary.
I mean, one does not expect it. No offense, sir. But your General Lee is an English general, sir."
"Extraordinary.
He has gained some reputation, sir, as of course you know, but there is a tendency in Europe to, think of Americans as, somewhat behind the times. Sometimes what,
How do I say this? One is on tricky ground here, but, sir, of course you understand. There are these cultural differences. A new